High Court judge, and what was it, highly esteemed. But a little bird told me that on two occasions, an effigy of you has been burnt. So clearly not esteemed by everybody. What happened?
The first occasion, I think I was burnt in effigy in Karachi. And the reason I was burnt in effigy in Karachi was that I had presided over the trial of the Pakistani cricketers who were done for spot fixing in this country.
Right,
you may recall that a few years ago. And I duly sent to prison. Well, that didn't make me the most popular person in Pakistan. I always thought if I took a holiday to India, I'd be much more popular.
Yes, you would.
And the other occasion, from Karachi to Lewes in Sussex, a county town in Sussex, where they have huge bonfire celebrations, and they have bonfire societies, and there are nine, I think, who each produce a float of a character that they love to hate. And what had happened was that two of the sponsors of one of those bonfire societies had run a fireworks manufacturing outfit, a factory. And, well, it's not so funny when you get there, because they had military explosives there.
Oh, right.
And when I say military explosives, those of your lawyers who may know that fireworks and explosives were categorised, this was Category 1, and the mortars that they used to round off the show were enormous. And prejudicially, they brought one in before the jury. It was a cartoon-type bomb. You know, you almost expect to see the word bomb on a great big ball with a fuse coming out the top. But the point was that these had been stored in a container, and the container caught fire. And the fire brigade called, and the fire brigade weren't told there were these explosives in
there. Oh, right.
And two of them were blown to pieces, and literally.
Oh, I see. Oh, dear.
So these two chaps were prosecuted for gross negligence manslaughter.
Absolutely.
And went down, and I duly sentenced them to prison. Their friends didn't think that was a very good idea, so I was
right.
Burnt in effigy yet again. But as long as it's only an effigy.
Indeed. let's have a look at this. I'm pretty certain. Oh, I'm off. Sorry. Are you on?
I think I'm on, yes.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought I'd switch it. I must have switched it the wrong way. Jeremy, High Court judge, what sort of cases were you... Oh, I'm swimming around again. This is real problem. My legs are very short, you see. I'd have to go very low. But anyway, what sort of cases did you sort out?
Well, I obviously did a bit of crime. And
yes.
I did sort of heavy crime. But really, my area of specialism was what I did at the bar, which was commercial work. So this world of banking and insurance and derivatives and all that sort of stuff was home territory for me.
And did you find that interesting?
Yes, it's intellectually challenging.
I'm sure.
Paper very heavy, or now electronic very heavy. But yes, so I did that at the bar.
And do you have a standout trial? You think, that was one case.
Yes, probably there was a 4 month one I did involving a bank not too far away from
me. Oh, it's typical of them, isn't it?
Yes. It's a foreign exchange case, and they were trying to recover a mere 250 million in the context of the 2008 crash on someone, one of their dealers, who was not satisfied that they had behaved themselves, so he was counterclaiming for 8 billion. So,
were you on commission? All right.
It was an enormously long case. It took me a month to write.
And was there a jury?
No.
All right. Okay.
I was going to say. Stood at all.
Yeah.
So, 800 page judgment.
Wow. So amazing.
Kept me going for a bit.
I'm sure it did. So, Jeremy, let's go back to your childhood. What sort of a family did you have? Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in sort of outer suburbs of London. Croydon, Purley, Wallingham, that sort of area. Went to school in
a family of lawyers?
My father was a lawyer, though he was the first to become such. He'd left school at 14 and been a tea boy and made his way up the tree, and he practiced as a solicitor for over 50 years.
Did he really? Yes. Yeah. All right. And was it a Christian family?
It was, yes.
So you were taken to church as a little child?
Yes.
Did you ever rebel against it?
Well, I think in one's teenage years, you'd be a little unusual if you did perhaps.
All right.
But I sort of went through the teenage angst thing quite early, I think.
Right.
And it was at that sort of stage I was beginning to know, what's all this really about? You know, what is life about? And I was pretty depressed about what I could see going on around about me. And really what came across in the end were two things, I think. First, if Christianity is true, then I've got to live by it. And I was persuaded that it was, in part by what I think we may be discussing. The evidence for the resurrection.
All right.
And I was persuaded by that. But secondly, I was persuaded by simply watching the example of believers, people who were Christians, who were a little bit older than I was, and the authenticity of their life and the attractiveness of it and the purpose in it made me realize that it's not just a question of what you hold in your mind, believing that Christ died and rose again, but actually how that really impacts on you, committing yourself to what you believe and committing yourself to Jesus.
So, just briefly, do you remember when you did commit yourself to Jesus?
I couldn't say there was a day and night.
No, all right.
Sorry, it was a gradual process.
But you became convinced.
A couple of years, I suppose, something of that kind.
So, all your legal life, as it were, you've been a Christian?
Yes.
And has that ever created, I don't know, contradictions, difficulties? Sort of questions of integrity. Huh? Can a Christian do what I'm being asked to do here?
Yes, I'm not a problem in terms of theory. We believe in a God of justice, and human justice is pretty rough and ready, but it's a great comfort to know that ultimately there'll be complete justice, perfect justice, 100% justice. Mm. And coming with that perspective, I think, is quite helpful. One does one's best, and I need all the help I could get, but in the end, that mistakes are obviously made.
I was going to ask that, it's a bit naughty of me, but I'm quite fascinated. My father was a solicitor as well, so fascinated by the law. As a judge, reflecting back, what percentage of cases do you think came up with the wrong verdict?
Do you mean me?
Well, presumably there are juries as well, so we'll include those too.
Well, you'll think I'm very vain. I was overturned in the Court of Appeal 3 times, I think, in my 15 years or so on the bench, and I think they only got it right once.
Really? So basically you're saying just on two occasions, on two occasions you made a mistake.
No, on one occasion.
On one occasion, sorry, I didn't follow the...
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, that's...
And that applies to juries as well, you think?
Juries, on the serious stuff, juries get it right, by and large, the serious stuff. The murders and so on, because the police spend a lot of time getting the evidence together, and the picture usually becomes quite clear. On the small stuff, I'm afraid it's very hit and miss. I used to...
Well, that's reassuring.
Yes.
All right. Jeremy, sorry. Let's come on to the evidence then. So, Jonathan said the birth, we can sort of accept, though I think some would say a virgin birth, and we'll want to question that, but we're going to leave that for the moment. Then we come on to the fact that if Jesus lived, and there's tremendous evidence for that, I don't think we're going to dispute that, and died, did he really rise from the dead? The body that went into the grave, did that body come out? Now, you've looked at the evidence for this. How do you think if the evidence was being presented in a court of law, it would stand up?
Well, a number of well-known lawyers have said that looking at the evidence, there's only one conclusion you've come to. Now, that's not persuasive in itself, the fact that lawyers say that. Lawyers can say all sorts of things, can't they? But the reality of it is that if you start from, so to speak, the common ground, the one thing that is absolutely clear and beyond dispute was that at the time, nobody doubted that the tomb was empty.
Right.
That was absolutely accepted. So all sorts of fancy theories can be forgotten. And there were only two rival explanations at the time, by those who supported the idea of the resurrection and those who were against it. And the idea against it was the body had been stolen. And one of the gospel writers tells us when he's writing about 30 years or later, he says, and this is the story that's still going around, that the leaders, the authorities put it out that his friends had come and stolen the body. And he says, that's what they still say now. And 150 years later, we have a debate that we can read about between a Christian and a Jew, and that's still the story that's being put around. Justin and Trifo, and the story being put out is, the explanation is, they stole the body. But as soon as you start looking at that as a possibility, you begin to realise just how absurd it is. in terms of Roman guards and the way they operate.
Well, they said they were asleep and people came and stole the body.
Yes, well, that's a good cross-examination question. How do you know what happened if you were asleep?
Exactly, yes.
But leaving aside that rather cheap point.
I'm sorry, that's my level.
I mean, the reality is, I've looked into this a bit.
Yes.
And the ordinary little group of Roman soldiers we put up to guard would be a group of about 16. Mm-hmm. And the way it worked was that 12 of them would sleep during the night for periods. Four would be absolutely on guard at the place, awake for 4 hours at a time. So there'd be four, usually, standing in front of the place they're guarding, here at two. Mm-hmm. There'd be another 12 who would sleep with their heads pointing inwards in semicircles around the area they're guarding. So anybody who's going to get to the tomb has got to walk through 12 bodies and find four people who are asleep. I've then got to roll back this enormous stone, which is probably the order 1.5 tons if it's covering a 5-foot hole, like a great millstone, silently get into the tomb, unwrap the body, and this is an extraordinary thought when you think about it. If you're going to steal a body, why would you unwrap all the sticky embalming cloths?
And have a naked corpse.
And carry out the naked corpse. Mm-hmm. And they're doing all this in a rush, but totally silently, in such a way as not to disturb anybody. And they get in there, and then they unwrap the body, and then they tiptoe quietly out into the dark without disturbing anybody at all. Now, I could develop that at some length, but the reality is that as an idea, it's pretty far-fetched. Now, of course, you say the idea of resurrection is pretty far-fetched. Well, yes, it is, in the sense that it's not part of our ordinary experience. But the question is, which of the two is more probable? Mm. And in courts of law, in civil courts, you proceed on the basis of what is more probable or not. In criminal courts, you proceed on the basis of are you sure, which is a slightly higher standard. But whichever way you look at it, I think the reality is that the evidence points to Jesus rising.
Well, now, Jeremy, can I be devil's advocate? Do
you mind?
What if Jesus never really died? Perhaps he just swooned on the cross and they took an unconscious body and thought they were burying a dead body, but they weren't. And somehow, in the tomb, he recovers. Is that a possibility?
Right. Imagine, I just want you to imagine for a minute, that you have been beaten up by a group of Roman soldiers. You've been tortured. You have been flogged. Flogged to within an inch of your life, because that's how they did it. They got you just to the point where they were about to die and then they stopped. So you're beaten absolutely raw. And then you're taken off after all this to be crucified, which is one of the most excruciating ways of dying that is. Mm. And the way that works is they put you up on this bit of wood, and the evidence we can see from skeletons that they found of people who've been crucified, they put a nail through your two ankles faced sideways and then through your hands like so, and your problem is that you can't really breathe very easily, because if you think of yourself hanging on a cross with a pin through your ankles, you've got to be constantly doing this to breathe, and every time you try and do that, of course, you're pulling on the hand, so the pain is excruciating. And in the end, people die not from the pain but from asphyxiation. Simply they're unable to have the strength to raise themselves to breathe. And so it takes time, usually a matter of hours. The way that they ensure that you're dead is either to come and break your bones at the end or to stick a spear into you. And we know from the evidence that we have, but in Jesus' case they stuck a spear into him, and we know that blood and water came out, which showed that the heart had stopped, and so on and so forth.
So they're not breaking the bones is significant, because in the Old Testament part of the Bible, written before Jesus was born, one of the prophecies is that his bones would be pulled apart, but not a bone of his body broken.
Yes, because one of the ways they finished them off was just to break their
and then they couldn't hoist themselves up,
and then they died of asphyxiation straight away. So the idea is not dead is really a nonsense. But anyway, you imagine being in the tomb. How do you get out? A bit of a problem. Again,
when you're tightly wrapped, yes.
Well, what they did, we know 75 pounds worth of spices were used to wrap up Jesus. This is not like a mummy. This is a simply a way of wrapping the body as part of Jewish ceremonial in wrappings with resin and aloes and so on in between each layer, which is there simply to stop the smell, because the body is decomposed so quickly. And they would do that in either two or three bits of wrappings. And they did that. And we know Joseph and Nicodemus had done that. And so, like so. And he has to get out of that. And then he has to get out of the tomb.
And then go around showing everyone that he's alive and well.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
All right.
So that one, I think, you can really say is completely out the window. And the Jews never suggested that. And the idea that a Roman execution squad didn't know how to fulfil its duty in killing people. This is their job, killing people. If you know how to execute people, you do.
Yeah, and I'm not an expert, but it's
but
never
we know that Pilate sent for the officer to ensure that he was dead before he was willing to let the body go. So it would be more than any centurion's life was worth to let the body go and wasn't dead. It's a long starter.
All right, what about, you know, people say Elvis lives.
Yeah.
What about, they just revered Jesus. So he's done the most amazing things. He's made the blind people see, deaf hear, mute speak, lame walk, raised the dead, fed the hungry, calmed the storm. Wow, he had a following. And then he's crucified. Could it be that they just wished that he was alive? And so the story went round.
Well, it's a bit of a downer if the man you've been following for 3 years and thought was going to become a political figure, a king, certainly someone who was going to restore the kingdom to Israel and the rule of God as they saw it, is then executed as if he was a criminal. And we know that it was not a terrible battle. They were terrified, the disciples, the friends of Jesus. They were afraid they were next on the list. Unsurprising. And so we know from what we're told that they were depressed and they hid. And the last thing they were expected to happen was that he would be seen again. And it came as a terrible surprise to them. And when others first told them, ladies were the first people to see him, they didn't believe it. And one of them, you know, Thomas, he said, well, unless I can actually physically touch him and see the marks in his hands and the place in his side where he was pierced with a spear, I'm never going to believe. A week later he sees him and that's that. So psychologically, the idea that they would simply invent this story from the position they were in, total depression, and then go around telling the world about it and being prepared to die for it themselves, it's pretty unlikely.
I think as well, the Romans, the Jews, would want to say, hey, look, you say he's risen. We have the body.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, that's why I started.
Yes.
Nobody doubted the body
of
God.
And so if it was just a made-up lie, many of these arguments would be exactly the same, wouldn't they?
Sure.
But what about hallucination? What about, you know, they I don't know, they saw something. And they thought, oh, this is Jesus. I don't know. It's not just a vision, not just a dream. We've seen him.
Well, we've got at least 13 occasions, haven't we, as recorded. And on one of them, 500 people at a time. So you're talking about a mass hallucination all of a sudden, as well as individuals. Again, that's highly improbable that people are going to have that. In fact, I don't think there's ever any evidence of a mass hallucination of that kind. I don't know. Others may know more about hallucinations than I do.
And again, the body is still, it would still be in the grave, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But, all right, so these are, you're giving very credible arguments against these possibilities. But what is the positive evidence? We've got the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. Is that it? Have we got anything else?
Well, what we're talking about is evidence here, right? Well, what is evidence?
Do you know, I'd want to ask a high court judge that,
right.
I think. That would be a really good definition.
Well, if you go on YouTube, you may see me eating a daffodil. Mark is over there and knows all about my daffodil eating. And the reason I do that is very simple. I eat a daffodil so that people can, I can say to them, if you go back from this room and you say the speaker ate a daffodil, people will say, you're having me on. But if two of you went and said it, then they think, well, maybe there's something in it. If 10 people who were all here went and said it, they think it's much more likely. If 500 people said it, there's something to talk about, isn't there? And the reality is, however improbable something is, if people say what they have seen and heard, that's what is evidence. That's all evidence is, people, witnesses saying, I've seen this, I heard this, this happened to me. And all evidence in the court of law comes down essentially to that. So what we have here, and we have, I simply ask people to look at the records in the Gospels and say, here is the evidence of people who have written down what they saw and heard, or what in fact someone else has told them they saw and heard. So in the case of Mark, he probably got it from Peter. John, we know, saw it himself. Matthew, we know, saw it himself. Luke appears to have got a great chunk of his story from Mary and from others and so on.
And was so a very, very accurate historian, wasn't he, Luke?
He went to some trouble to make sure he got it right in date.
Sorry, what happened when you ate the daffodil?
What happened? I didn't die.
did you have any ill effects?
No, as long as you eat just the yellow bit at the top. Don't eat the stalk. The stalk is likely to give you trouble.
All right. But if you eat the yellow, do you have any trouble?
No. I do this for some regularity.
We do have some good refreshments back there. You don't need to anyway. And
it's completely tasteless, in fact, the top of that. It just sort of dissolves in your mouth.
Good, I'm glad you told me that, because I wasn't going to try, but thank you. Let me just ask, you mentioned 500, and that's because on one occasion Jesus appeared to over 500 people at one time.
Yeah.
Amazing. I also think it's interesting about the two, Jesus appeared first to two women. And in those days, women wouldn't really be credible witnesses. And
well, their evidence wasn't admissible.
Yes, if you were wanting to make up a story, you wouldn't have written it like this, would you? It's quite. And are there any? I don't know. Are there other writings beside Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
Well, there are plenty of other writings that come from a bit later on, of course.
Right.
No question about that. We have, of course, records from Jewish historian Josephus and from Roman historian Tacitus, and indeed a bit in Suetonius, which are about the early Christian church, and they of course refer to Jesus as the character whom the early Christians were following.
Yes.
So there's plenty of stuff about the early church to show that there was, from very earliest days, a group of people who firmly did believe that Jesus had died and risen again, and were now living out life in what was seen even by these people as being a pretty exemplary way. As a result of being Jesus' followers.
So if the evidence for the resurrection was presented to you in a high court and you analysed it, you would be pretty well convinced that, hey, this is accurate. Jesus not only lived, died, but rose again.
You've got to account for the evidence, that's the point. And if you've got people who are reliable as witnesses, and this is always the key when you're looking at evidence, how reliable is the witness in front of you? And these are people for whom integrity and truth was one of the highest values, as Jesus himself focused on the truth, what was true, so they did too. And therefore, in terms of the character of the witnesses concerned, if they were standing in front of me, I would think that they were likely to be believed. And so when they all say, I saw him on this occasion, I saw him on that occasion, he ate, he drank, I could touch him, he cooked us breakfast on the beach, you know, all these sorts of things. You know, you've got to come up with a solution. How do you account for this evidence? I was talking to a man at a rather similar thing like this, and he was about 80, I think. And he said, you know, I have real trouble in the idea that Jesus was the Son of God. So I said, well, how do you account for it? What do you think? He said, that's a good question. But he didn't give me an answer.
All right.
But it caused him to think, because the reality is, how do you explain a man who teaches these things, extraordinarily high ethical values, and then claims that he is someone from another place, claims that he's God, does things that only God does, forgives sins, raises other people from the dead, heals diseases, dies, comes back to life just as he predicted he would. How do you explain all this?
Absolutely. We had a text question that came in earlier. Why is this important? Why can't we just see it as symbolic? You know, that it's a nice thought that he rose from the dead, and perhaps that teaches that God has victory power over over death and over the grave, and it's a nice sort of metaphor. Why is it so important to take it literally?
justice.
Go on.
Justice. if you think about the epitome of wrongdoing, the ultimate evil, the ultimate injustice, a fixed trial, a judge who thinks the man, knows the man in front of him is innocent but condemns him just the same. What's going on? And what we are told from Jesus' teaching and that of his friends is that what's going on here is that Jesus is dying and taking on himself all the evil of the world. He's taking responsibility for the rejection of God, which in fact is what's going on. People are trying to do away with him. They're trying to do away with God. They don't want him in their lives. And yet he takes the responsibility on himself. And what we're told is this is how we in fact can be reconciled to God, because God in his justice is prepared to take responsibility for all the injustices that we do. And to a lawyer that's quite a significant idea. But of course he couldn't simply stay dead, because unless he rose again from the dead, one wouldn't see that the whole matter had been solved, that God was satisfied and that Jesus was vindicated. Having taken responsibility, he then goes back once he came.
And if he really did rise, he's totally unique, isn't he? Because nobody else in history has ever defeated death, gone into a grave, lay there for 3 days, not corrupting, but he's lying in the grave, and then by his own power rises. That is stunning.
Yes, there's a difference between the three people we know that he raised from the dead during his time, because each of them was going to die. They were raised from the dead, but their body was again going to decay, corrupt, get old like I am, and bits fall off and all the rest of it. And they would die. But in his case, when he rose again, not a physical body like yours and mine, but the sort of body that you and I will have when we die and rise to be with him.
Because it was a different body. You could touch it.
Yes.
It was a real body. He ate, as we know, and yet he could go through walls.
Absolutely. And in fact, what's one of the interesting things, which again you wouldn't expect if people were making up a story, is that people had trouble recognising him. He wasn't. There was something a little bit different about him. They knew who it was, but immediately they weren't quite sure. And it's quite interesting.
Well, you don't expect people to rise from the dead, do you?
Well, you don't. But on the other hand, if you've been with someone for 3 years, you know them pretty well. Going through death is quite an experience, I guess. But it also holds out hope for you and I that we'll look rather better.
Well, I was going to say this, you see. Oh, I see. I was going to say, people have said to me, oh, how do you know about life after death? How do you know about heaven and hell? Nobody's ever come back to tell us. But, of course, what you're saying and what Christians believe is that somebody did. And he's the one actually who spoke most about heaven and hell.
And one of the funny things is this, isn't it? Jesus told a story about a man, he was a man who died, and he was receiving the just reward for his misdoing. And he said, let me go back and warn my brothers about all this so that they don't make the terrible mistake and leave God out. And Jesus in the story has Moses saying to him, even if someone rose from the dead, they wouldn't take any notice. And of course, that's the reality of huge numbers of people today.
It is. Now, are you wanting, because we're looking at the evidence, are you wanting us just to be, all right, I tick that box, I can see that Jesus rose from the dead, or are you wanting more from individuals when you share this? I know the answer to the question, but do it, elucidate.
Well, it comes back to where I began.
Yes.
But as a teenager, I realised it wasn't just a question of mental assent. You can believe anything you like, but if it doesn't impact on you, if it doesn't really have an effect. And being a Christian is all about trusting your life to Christ and saying, he is my boss, he's my master, he's my Lord. And the whole point of the crucifixion and then the resurrection and the ascension is that he is exactly who he says he is. Mm. He's God, he's Lord, and he deserves my loyalty and allegiance. Mm. And actually, it's the only thing that makes sense of what otherwise would be a completely futile life. Mm. God's made you for a reason, and the reason is to relate to him and to serve him and to be his agent in the world for his purposes, doing good, etc., etc. And so the thing hangs together consistently. It would be an oddity, in a sense, to believe it in your mind and not do anything about it.
Jeremy, if you don't mind, just stay here, and we're going to take questions in a moment. I just want to sort of draw thoughts together quickly. I don't think I've ever sort of thought this is completely unnecessary from me, because you've covered all I want to say very, very ably. But could I just say, I think one of the significant things here is that the Old Testament part of the Bible, that written before Jesus was born, prophesies these things. I often say about Jesus that his biography was written before he was born. So where he'd be born, how he'd be born, how he'd live, how he'd work, some of the things he'd say, some of the things he'd do, and then his death, and then his rising again, all spoken about before he did die and rise. In fact, before he lived. And Jesus himself, when people began to realise that he is indeed the Son of God, then he began to speak and say, look, I am going to die, I'm going to be crucified and rise from the dead. But it wasn't just, as it were, a judge saying, all right, crucify him. Actually, Jesus had come for this. I would argue, you'll have to listen to me on this, otherwise you might think, oh, this guy's a bit weird. I would argue Jesus is the only man in all of history who chose to die. On one occasion he said, destroy this body, and in 3 days I will raise it. But he also said, no man can take my life from me. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it up again. Nobody could take his life from him. And yet they crucified him. But you know, when Jesus was on the cross, he made 7 statements. And the final one was, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. When Jesus was there, as Jeremy so well explained, the sin of the world was laid on him. Our wrongdoing. Jesus, he took the can for. He paid the penalty that it would take us all eternity to pay. But he, the eternal one, in those hours of suffering, paid for our sin on the cross. But then he dismissed his spirit. He gave himself over to death, because he is the life. Who could take his life from me? Now, when I said nobody else chose to die, somebody could say, oh no, just a moment, Roger, I know so-and-so who committed suicide. But actually, they didn't choose to die. They chose when and how and where. But Jesus chose to lay down his life. The Bible says he tasted death for every one of us. So he carried our sin, he tasted death, and then this risen Jesus is the one who sort of appeals, yes, to a world, but to us individually. And he appeals to us to receive his forgiveness. And, you know, once we ask him, because he's paid for our sin, to forgive our sin, he brings us into a relationship with himself that lasts not only for time, but for all eternity. It's a wonderful thing to be able to put your head on your pillow at night and think, if I never wake up, I'm going to wake up with God. But if I do wake up the next morning, I'm going to, with him, live the day that he's given me. So there is tremendous significance in all of these things, but there is a challenge to us that we do need to come to that moment where we ask him to forgive us and live within us. So for Jeremy, somewhere in his teens, for me, again, in my teens, actually in the Middle East, some missionaries who ran a Christian hospital told me about Jesus dying for me and how he could forgive me. And I trusted him. I asked him to become my Lord and Saviour. And it was the hinge which changed the whole direction of my life.